Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Good to be with you today. Are you listening on a mobile device? Are you listening on your computer online? How safe are those devices, those mobile devices? How about listening, or how about using the internet? How safe are those? Are there temptations there on the internet, on that mobile device? How about for the young people in your home, if you have kids, if you have teens? How easy is it for them to come across material that you would rather them not, that you do not want them to encounter? We're going to talk about that today with our friends from Covenant Eyes. We're going to talk with Luke Gilkerson from Covenant Eyes in just a moment. Hope you can join us for that conversation as we talk about online safety and mobile devices with kids and teens right here on Faith and Family. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program. To find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin, go to our website, kfuo.org, and there you can find information about our sponsors, particularly Concordia University, Wisconsin, CUW. CUW is located in, you'll find their information in our sponsor section. You'll find their logo there. Click on that, and that'll take you to more information about Concordia University, Wisconsin. Joining me by phone this morning, Luke Gilkerson. He is the general editor and primary author of the Covenant Eyes blog at covenanteyes.org. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning, Andy. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, glad to have you back. Thanks for taking some time to talk with us this morning on Faith and Family. For our listeners not familiar with Covenant Eyes, can you give us that intro, that explanation of what Covenant Eyes is?
Absolutely. Well, Covenant Eyes is a software company, and our specialty is accountability software. Accountability software is distinct from filtering software in a number of ways. People tend to be familiar with filtering in the sense that you put it on your computer and it's going to block the sites that you want it to block, that you don't want to show up on your screen. And we do have an optional filter for families who want to use that. But the centerpiece of our software is our accountability. Accountability is different in the sense that accountability allows you to go wherever you want online, but it's going to summarize all of the places you've gone into a report that is sent regularly to the people that you trust. What this does is it creates an openness and honesty about where people are going online. When people volunteer this kind of information, it actually gives them the sense that what they do online really does impact their life offline, that having secret corners where they can do whatever they feel like they want on the internet is often just a recipe for sin, a recipe for disaster in people's lives. And so by opening this up, by giving someone access to your internet history and what you're doing online, it creates openness and honesty. And where there's a problem, say someone's looking at pornography or someone's got a habit of doing this, people will be around you who know the truth of what you're doing and can help you about it. So it's a great tool for parents who want to monitor their children and to try to prevent problems before they become big problems. It's also great for adults and is primarily used by adults who really want to prevent the same kind of habits in their own life or want to stop the habits that they've started. And so it's used by, we've got over 150 some odd users around the globe, and that's what we do.
Wow. Around the globe.
Yeah.
Looking at it primarily, here in the United States, for young people, for children or for teens, what's the likeliness that a child or a teen would encounter pornography just using the internet? Say they're doing a project for school and they're using a search engine to research something. Is it likely that they're going to encounter pornography in that process?
In the process of doing what you might consider, say, innocent searching, about 25% of teens, and so let's say you're talking about, 16, 17, it's like you're talking about high school kids. About 25% of teens have seen sexual content on the internet that they did not intend to see. So that is, in the process of doing other things, they're seeing sexual content that was not on their radar. It was not why they got online. It was not what they were searching for. And that's a, relatively high percentage when you consider the amount of searches that people do and how much teens are online. When you're talking about teens that are actually searching for pornography, and including those in the numbers, more than 90% of boys will see porn before they graduate from high school. More than 60% of girls will see porn before they graduate from high school. Those are astronomically high numbers. And so we're talking about something that is very common today, what teens are going to be exposed to.
You know, we were talking about just doing homework. You know, today it's not uncommon for students to need to use a computer and with internet access in order to do homework, to do assignments, to do research.
For
a paper.
Yeah, all the time, and that's it's key. Now, of course, there are a lot of safeguards in place, and a lot of people use those safeguards. People who don't want to, you know, view this kind of material, a lot of people can steer clear of it when they're not searching for it. That's true. But when you consider the volume of time that people spend online today, and especially as you consider the insurgence of mobile technology with tablets, smartphones, stuff like that, you're talking about a massive shift in the way people even think about getting online these days. Now, because you can literally carry around this access in your pocket, people are getting online at all hours of the day and night for just... momentary decisions. You know, I want to look something up. I want to check Facebook. I want to check Twitter. I want to check Instagram. I want to go to various social sites that I'm on, or I want to look something up on Wikipedia or whatever. People do this kind of stuff now all hours of the day and night because they're more or less constantly plugged in. So when you consider the volume of time people are spending online, and then, of course, the volume of pornography that's available online, the opportunities for exposure are enormous. Someone with the right motives, or should I say the wrong motives, someone with the motives to want to look at this stuff, it is very easy to access. And of course, for the kids who even aren't intending to, it is still very easy to come across. We talk to teens routinely about this, that they can't even get on Facebook anymore without seeing, you know, sort of user-generated sexual content that their friends, even the stuff that their friends are posting. So we're not even talking about pornographic material that's being put out by multimillion-dollar companies. We're talking about even just user-generated stuff. We're talking about sexting. We're talking about things that people are posting about their private lives, photos that they're posting, photos they're sending to one another. The instances of this are only increasing. It's upward now somewhere that about 30% of teens are receiving sexually provocative pictures and all the way up to nude pictures from their peers through mobile devices. And these are people that are receiving it, sometimes not even provoked. They're just receiving it from people who are flirting with them online or whatever. It is so the instances of this are very, very high these days. And parents really do need to be aware of it. Even if you've got a kid that you think is largely clean on these things, if you think doesn't have the motivation to go after these things, first, it's really important to remember your kids are as susceptible to temptation as you remember being as a teen. That's first important to remember. And second, even when you've got your head screwed on straight, and even when you've got your best intentions, it's still important to remember that pornography is coming after them.
The people are putting it out there in very easy ways, intending and targeting them as an audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's go back and define something earlier we call screen time. What does screen time include? We talked about being on a computer or now mobile devices.
Right.
What does screen time entail?
Screen time. Well, we're basically just talking, it sounds like what it is. It's time in front of a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And this in and of itself has psychologists concerned. Because when you're talking about time in front of a screen, this is we're living in an age where the amount of screen time is unprecedented compared to previous ages.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly, most of your listeners will probably remember growing up with a television.
Sure.
That was some kind of screen time. And even then, even early on, American Psychological Association, they were early on, back in the 70s and 80s even, were putting out warnings saying, you know what, when it comes to kids and screen time, we got to try to limit this because we're starting to notice that this is causing, we believe it's causing some problems, just the excessive amount of screen time. Now, you amplify that to the fact that a lot of people, especially teens, have access to screens all the time and are constantly surrounded by screens. In fact, this is even the move you're seeing in schools, where schools are dishing out, iPads and making them a part of the educational experience. right? This has just become part and parcel of what people are doing in their daily lives. And what this does, what are the concerns? There's a number of, we have an article about this on our blog that's very, very recent. We just published it last week. And it's talking about even just the neuroscience that's going into this as people are now starting to map the brains of people who are spending a lot of time in front of screen. And the long and the short of it is that excessive screen time can really lead to a general cognitive slowness that it leads to this desire for a cravings for more screen time and a sort of restlessness without it, and a diminished ability for the brain to plan, prioritize, organize, fight impulses, and develop empathy with people. That all that from just excessive screen time. Now, of course, once you tack on the things that are on those screens, now you have a whole other matter too. So that first we're talking about the medium, right? We're talking about the medium of the screen itself has got its own complications. But now it's the content of what's out there, which is, of course, scary enough. That's the stuff parents tend to think about. They tend to think about what's the content on the screen, which is, of course, a concern. But we also have to go back to the screen itself as being something that parents also need to think about. How is this possibly rewiring the brains of their kids? And how is this possibly explaining a number of the psychological dynamics that we see more and more common among teens these days?
I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 screens facing me right now.
Yeah.
So does that mean I'm five times more in trouble?
You know what? It actually has a lot to do with what's with the speed of what's on those screens. It's not just staring at a monitor. It's not just pixels. It has a lot to do with the speed of things that are happening on the screen. Just looking at just typing in a word processor is going to have a different effect on you than if you're watching a live action film. Things are processing very differently in the brain. So there's nuances to that. So it's not just that I'm staring at a screen. It's what you're doing. It's how the screen is interacting with you. So those are things to keep in mind. I have a desk job too. I stare at a screen all day. So I get that. But often the level of work, the kind of work happening on a screen. Now, of course, there's other things to be concerned about too. You can burn your retinas and stuff. I mean, I get all that. But aside from that, what we're talking about here is we're talking about the type of interactions people are having on screens are often very different. It's also this, I will say this too, the internet has a dynamic of this constant clickability and novelty. This is one of the reasons why internet pornography in particular is even more addictive than pornography that people consumed when it was just in magazines, because there is this constant sense of novelty that something is around the next corner, just around the next click, and you don't know what it is when you click on it. And this has been demonstrated in even scientific findings where they're saying that internet addiction is propelling porn addiction at astronomical rates. It's why, sadly, you get boys who enter into adulthood having grown up, having watched, pornography for the last, 8-10 years of their life constantly. Right now we're seeing that upwards of about 35% of boys are saying, these are young teen boys are saying, I've seen pornography more times than I can count. That's their words. That 35% of boys are saying that I've seen porn more times than I can count. And then they're entering adulthood and they do not, their brains do not know how to function with real women because they have been so used to what they get on the screen that everything is clickable, customizable, exact to the specifications of the person who's wanting it. And the fact is that real life is not that clickable and not that customizable. And so their brains have gotten used to this, and now they're having to function in a world, in a real world, and find themselves unable to do it. This is becoming a major problem these days. And the internet as a medium is part of the reason why that's happening, is because it's all so incredibly interactive.
In the past, when we first encountered the internet as a society, it was on a computer that was on a desk or,
sure,
in a static place, and it didn't move around at home.
Mm-hmm.
How are things different today?
Well, like I said before, the mobile revolution has really taken hold. I mean, even 5 years ago. I mean, compared to 5 years ago, you know, how many smartphones were in the marketplace versus now? It's enormous. It's enormous difference. You know, these days, I will say this. So some of the stats behind this, if you consider it, right now we're looking at about 51% of millennials own a smartphone. And, you know, so we're talking, you know, the 18 to 34-year-old generation.
I figured it would...
actually a little older, a little old. When you consider things like one in five searches mm-hmm. from a mobile device is for something pornographic. One in five. I mean, how many times do you, if you have a smartphone, how many times do you search for something on that mobile device in a given week? Imagine if one in five of those searches were for something pornographic. You'd be watching a whole lot of porn. And that is what's going on these days. And why? It's because pocket porn, that's really what it is. This is something that, I mean, you're carrying around something in your pocket that, you know, can become like an X-rated theater in your pocket. And with that kind of accessibility, it's no wonder that we're seeing escalated rates of men coming into counseling offices saying, I am just hopelessly out of control with this porn thing. I can't seem to stop it. I've been looking at it since I was 10, and I don't know what to do. It's because they've had this constant access. And now that mobile technology's only become more available, it's only becoming more of an issue.
You mentioned earlier that with this generation of boys who have grown up with access to pornography, that in adult life they find themselves unable to interact with women in a healthy yeah. relationship.
Right.
What are some of the other? Are there other? I guess I don't know if side effects are the word. Are there other negative results? You know, negative things that result from exposure to pornography or an addiction to pornography?
Oh, there's plenty to say. I mean, we're seeing this right now. There's even online communities that are dealing with this from a physiological perspective. Young men who are saying that they're actually experiencing erectile dysfunction because they are unable, even when they're with a woman, a real flesh and blood woman, they can't seem to perform, sexually speaking. And a lot of that the problem is not the organ. The problem isn't in the organ. The problem's in the brain. And that's proven by the fact that these men go to doctors and they get the same, you know, erectile dysfunction medication that 70 and 80-year-old men are getting. And it works for the 70-year-old men. It doesn't work for the 20-year-old guy. And that's because the problem's not in the organ. It's in the brain. That is because of a rewiring that's taken place in the brain due to watching pornography. Now, that's just a physiological thing. But beyond that, there's other psychological issues that are going on there. Today's pornography, in general, it's always been this way, but the envelope's been pushed more and more these days, is that today's pornography is increasingly misogynistic and violent. 88% of scenes in the top-selling porn films contain acts of physical aggression paired with sexuality. They're sexualizing aggression. They're sexualizing an aggressive type of sexuality. And that is, they're eroticizing it, meaning that it's not surprising, for instance, that when you go to, say, interview, and they've done this, they go to interview people, prostitutes, for instance. They have found 86% of prostitutes have said that clients come to them demanding that they perform the degrading things that they've seen in pornography, and they're traumatized by that. That's because they are conditioning themselves to want and desire this kind of physical violence paired with their sexuality. Now, of course, I'm not saying there was an old school kind of argument that said that, you know, if everyone had access to porn, then we'd live in a whole culture of, you know, rapists and violent people or whatever. That's not what I'm saying. And that's not what's happening. What is happening, though, is that normal men who otherwise would have no disposition to want, you know, to want anything. They are lowering the standard of what they consider violent, of what they consider misogynistic, to the point now where, you know, things like date rape are more common. To the point now where even women are expecting and anticipating to have to measure up to pornographic standards in their own sexual relationships. And they know they can't hold a guy's attention unless they do. This is the kind of thing that's happening in youth culture. And pornography is, of course, then becoming more commonplace in that way. Not surprisingly, people who are more and more into porn are less and less into things like marriage, or less and less into things like wanting to have children. This is the kind of stuff that's been measured in scientific studies. And there's been plenty of research on this kind of stuff, or even just the dehumanization of women in general. They see measured effects. There's experiments where men were brought into a lab setting and they were shown pornography, and then after weeks of doing this, they did exit surveys and they end up finding shifts in the people's thinking about how do you think about women, or how do you think about the rights of women. How do you think about the value of women, that kind of stuff, asking questions along those lines and seeing this noticeable shift, even after only watching, several hours of pornography spread out over several months. And today we're talking, this is happening in far greater amounts. And so, of course, it's going to be different for every person. Obviously, there's a lot of other competing factors that go into that, into people's thinking about these things. But the point is that what we're noticing today is more or less a tidal wave, a tsunami, if you will, of this kind of content. And we're just now watching the porn generation growing up into adulthood, and many of them sitting up, taking notice and saying, hold on a second, this thing that I thought was so harmless and so innocent and just an outlet and just a release of my own sexual fantasies or whatever, all of this is just, it's not worked. I find myself incapable of really functioning the way I want to function. This is not the kind of man I want to be. Something needs to change. And this coming, I might add, not just from the church, but coming from secular society, people saying these things, saying we have tried this and it has been found wanting. And this is a real issue today, and something that the church can really take advantage of, I think, because we spread a different message, a message about dignity and respect and honor, a message about the dignity of people and the dignity of women. And this is something that people are hungry to know. That people need to realize, you know what, this is true. You know, this age-old ethic of monogamy, or this age-old ethic of sexual purity, was not some just rigid standard, but a standard that was based on the way we were designed as people. And that is important to recognize, that this standard that we're meant to go back to, this biblical standard, is not merely done because God's offended at sexual immorality, but because God has designed people. God has not designed people for sexual immorality. This is part of the nature of who we are meant to be, is people who are bonded to one person for a lifetime, not to 1,000 digital images that are assaulting our consciousness.
And that are so readily available.
And everywhere.
Yeah, and everywhere, so easily accessible. You know, you said it perfectly earlier. We carry basically the whole internet around with us in our pocket now with mobile devices. And it's just so accessible. And right. I have to confess that I realized I miscounted with the screens facing me earlier. I forgot about my phone, so I have 6 screens facing me in the studio right now. We need to take a quick break. When we come back from that break, we'll continue our conversation on the online safety and internet accountability. We're talking with Luke Gilkerson. He's the general editor and primary author of the Covenant Eyes blog. Stick around for more Faith and Family right after this, right here on Listener Supported Worldwide, KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
An elderly Belgian couple arranged with the help of their son to both die by euthanasia at the same time. Neither spouse wants to live after the other has died. This scenario hit home because my colleague, Dr. Jack Wilkie, father of the pro-life movement, experienced the death of his wife, Barbara, just weeks prior to their 65th wedding anniversary. At first, Jack suffered deep but normal grief. He had lots of us praying for him, and he knows despite his grief, God still has a plan for him even without his dear Barbara. In the case of the Belgian couple, their son John Paul, yes, it's ironic, said it would be impossible for him to take care of them every day. Now we get to the heart of the matter. The old people are in the way.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, on behalf of Concordia Plan Services, Lutheran Church Extension Fund, the LCMS Foundation, Lutheran Housing Support Corporation, Concordia University System, and Corporate Synod, daily reaches out to our members and partners, working together to support our local, global, and international ministries, church workers, and LCMS initiatives at large to carry the mission forward and to serve each other in love. Opportunities to serve, lcms.org/jobsboard.
Finding just the right partner is a blessing when it comes to achieving God's plans. Hi, I'm Rich Robertson, President and CEO of the Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Before taking this position, I worked with LCEF in my home congregation. It was a joy to find a true Lutheran partner that understood our unique needs as we built a school and welcomed new families into our church and community. I hope you experience that joy too. Visit lcef.org to find out how your ministry can become empowered in its kingdom work.
Hi, this is Pastor Mark Azil, the LCMS Director of Campus Ministry and LCMSU, inviting all college students and those with an interest in campus ministry to join us for Taboo, the 2015 National LCMS Campus Ministry Conference, this coming January 5th through 7th at St. Louis University in St. Louis. That's right, it's Taboo in the Lou. Find out more at lcms.org/LCMSU.
This is a test of the emergency alert system. This has been a test of the emergency alert system.
Hi, I'm Pastor William Whedon, LCMS Director of Worship. Jesus said some hard things in John 6, and lots of his disciples turned away and stopped following him. He asked the 12 if they wanted to go too. Peter responded for them all, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life." Words of eternal life, those are the words your Jesus has for you. Join me for the next broadcast of Thy Strong Word, 11 a.m. Central on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Today we are talking with Luke Gilkerson. He's the general editor and primary author of the Covenant Eyes blog at covenanteyes.org. We're talking about internet safety, online safety, and today the accessibility of information, including things like pornography that are it's so accessible with mobile devices. Luke, when parents start thinking about their child having a phone, maybe they want their child to have a mobile device, a phone, for safety reasons. They want that instant communication, or maybe even something like, you know, a GPS device. Our family uses, an app that has a GPS tracking on it so that we know where the rest of the family is. Or we use them for shared calendars. It's great for sharing that kind of information instantly.
Absolutely.
So, families might want their child to have a mobile phone, a mobile device. what are the but then, you know, there comes that angst that, yeah, then my child has a phone that they have access to the internet and everything that's on the internet available to them from their phone.
Right. Well, there's a number of things that need to be done. The first thing that needs to be done, or I should say, let's assume that I'm talking to people whose children already have mobile devices. So they're not buying a new one right now. They're not just going out to the store right now to get one. They already have them. There's a couple things I would say to do. The first is that there needs to be a thorough inventory of what is on that phone. And by inventory, I mean they need to look at all of the apps that are there. What has been downloaded? What apps have been utilized by the child? They need to know what they are and what they access. So this can include games, other web browsers. This can include social media apps, all kinds of things, geolocation kind of stuff like you were mentioning, all the way down to the calculator they use. They need to know what these things access, which means if there's an app that you aren't sure what it is, you need to take note of the name of the app and go look it up online and find out what it is. For some parents, this may take a while because maybe their child has downloaded lots of apps, but it's worth it because their kids are worth it. And that's really, really key to note, is you have to do an app inventory. That's true whether you have an Android device, that's true whether you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch or whatever, or a tablet of some kind. You need to look at those apps and know what they access, especially since if you've got a child who knows what to look for, there are apps that are intentionally misleading. They intentionally look like something they're not. They might look like a calculator. They're actually a back-end web browser that can be used to access the web. That kind of stuff you need to take note of. So take note of what the apps are called, look them up, and see what's there. If there's something that you don't want your child to have, you can uninstall that app and get rid of it. That's the first step. The second step is to shore up and protect the avenues you want to protect. So there may be apps on there you want them to have, and that's fine. There may be access to web browsers or whatever you want them to have, and that's fine. So let's take, for instance, let's say you had an iPhone. That's a fairly popular one. Let's say you had an iPhone. What can you do? iPhone has on it built-in restrictions. In fact, Covenant Eyes, our own web browser that we invented for the iPhone, actually is designed to work hand-in-hand with those built-in restrictions. This is what people have asked us for, is, you know, we already know that iPhone has restrictions. And even recent updates of the iPhone have made these restrictions even better. There are built-in filters. There are built-in app lock controls that lock down the use of certain apps and lock down the ability to install new apps, or lock down the ability to uninstall apps so they can't just install something and then uninstall it and hide it. Those are the things. So those things need to be looked at thoroughly. Now, we have information on our website. So if you look up on the Covenant Eyes website, iPhone restrictions, you'll find tutorials on exactly how to do this, how to go into an iPad or an iPhone or an iPod Touch and go through and set all the restrictions of how to set it up properly so that everything is locked down that you want locked down. And I would recommend, especially for teens, I would recommend locking down the ability to install apps, and that if the child wants an app, say they want a free app or a new game or whatever, that they have to come to the parent and say, look, I want this app. Can you, you know, give the passcode and put it in and let me have the app? And the, you know, parent says, yeah, sure, that's fine. If it's an okay app, that's great. But it's just a way of keeping up with what apps are being installed here and what are they doing. And that's more than just for porn, right? I mean, that's more than just for the sake of not looking at porn. I mean, there may be apps you don't want on there for a host of reasons. Maybe the child is just really, really into gaming, and you don't want to give them an infinite number of games to constantly occupy their time when they should be doing their homework. You know, that's a parental decision you have to make. So anyway, lock down those abilities. Same thing with an Android device. Covenant Eyes for Android device is a little different than it is for iPhone. It's not a web browser like it is on the iPhone. Covenant Eyes for Android monitors the stock browser for that device, but it also monitors when other apps are used, and it has an app locking feature built into it. So you can use Covenant Eyes to actually lock down specific apps or the ability to install apps and those sort of things within Covenant Eyes itself. So those are, and again, if you go to Covenant Eyes, you look up Android restrictions, you'll see, again, tutorials on exactly how to do that. So you can look up all those, all that information. So it's the first step is making sure that what has been on the phone and what's been on the device is first cleaned up, making sure that you have a complete understanding of what's there. And then second step would be making sure that future use of that phone is restricted exactly the way you want it. Now, the big one in that restriction is the browser itself. How do you use the browser? Because that is the primary gateway. That's the primary access point where people might be getting into the pornography. If that's the case, so what we can do is a number of things you can do with that. First of all, if you install the Covenant Eyes app on the iPhone, for example, that can be both monitored and filtered. So you can both filter what's coming through that browser, and you can also monitor what's coming through that browser, and you get a report of all the places your kids are going on that browser. And then what you do is you simply lock down any other types of browsers that might be on the phone, like Safari or whatever. You're locking those apps down. So the one portal you have that the child has to the internet, to a browser experience on the internet, is through the Covenant Eyes browser exclusively. And then everything is monitored and filtered that way. On the Android, it's relatively similar, at least that you're instead of using a Covenant Eyes browser, you're using a stock browser that's on the machine, and Covenant Eyes is monitoring that. And so, again, you want to put Covenant Eyes on there, and then you can monitor what those things look like. So you can monitor that. We don't have a filter for the Android device yet, but that is in the works. So those things are ways that parents can kind of shore up and protect. Now, of course, it's not all foolproof. I mean, kids can find out ways around anything. All they have to do is pick up another device. So obviously what this needs to be paired with is good training and teaching about internet responsibility. It can't just be that we have these external blockades. Parents also need to do the hard work of reminding kids who they really are and who they really want to be, and pornography doesn't have a place in that vision. Those sort of things, or even just sexual interactions online or sexting or anything like that. All those things are not in keeping with what the kind of people that they're raising their kids to be. And those are the kind of hard conversations that parents still need to have. That software is not going to do that, do that kind of parenting for you. You still need to have those conversations.
That was my next question. You have accountability and filtering apps that are helpful for mobile devices. What about, as you mentioned earlier, sexting, sending a text message with a picture in it sending and receiving pictures that are sexual in nature or may even include nudity?
Mm-hmm. This is becoming more common, and this is something that needs to be dealt with. So what's important is making sure that you know what apps children can use on their device that have this capability. Now, most smartphones, all smartphones that I know of, usually have a built-in sort of camera. So, cameras are just part of the device itself. Mm-hmm. It's the sending, what can send those things? A texting program can send those sort of things. And it's really important that kids are educated about this. And I think one of the main things parents should do in education in this area, aside from any sort of teaching about, sexual, God's purpose for sex or sexual morality or those sort of things, in addition to that, I think the big one is they need to know that what goes out online is essentially permanent. You can delete photos, and people do delete photos, but it's very easy for anyone who gets a hold of those photos to copy and send them to anybody. In fact, this is happening more and more as you're seeing teens' lives and reputations really damaged by this kind of stuff. There's new stuff in the news all the time. In fact, I would encourage parents to use current events as a great catalyst for this. Kids need to know that this is not just harmless flirtation. This is something that can easily be spread, and not even in the way that they anticipate. It's not just that you're going to have, a sexual picture to somebody, and they're really malicious, and later on they share it with their buddies or something like that. That does happen, but those pictures can easily fall into the wrong hands of people who are just trying to prank who are just trying to be funny, and they don't think about the long-term ramifications of what they're doing. And as a result, you're putting your own image, into the hands of people that you really can't trust. And so it's so important for parents to impress this on their kids, that this is the kind of stuff that you just do not want floating around out there on the internet, on people's phones. And like I said, use current events. It's the best way to spark the conversation. Just say, this is, you know, look what happened to this girl, look what happened to this guy when this thing's happened. This is why it's so important that you keep this stuff out of people's hands, and why it's so important not to use your camera or your texting programs to do that.
It's just crazy and phenomenal to think that, you know, 20 years ago, we probably wouldn't have even thought about the fact that you can carry the internet around with you, that you can have instant access to someone anywhere in the world, really, now with a mobile device. You can not only talk to them over the phone, but that you can send them basically anything, any kind of information, text, photo, video, anything can be sent right, instantaneously.
Yeah.
Online. It's just something we wouldn't have, I don't know, I wouldn't have thought of necessarily 20, 30 years ago.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's unprecedented in a lot of ways. It's really important for people to understand this kind of, and you know, and nothing really has prepared us for this mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. I mean, certainly technology gurus have known what's on the horizon for a long time. But I think as far as the general public goes, you know, we've really been hit by this kind of stuff. In some ways, it feels like it kind of crept up on us, and here we are, you know, living in it. And we, you know, even still now, are just kind of still establishing the rules of the road. I'm sure 20 years from now, things will there'll be a new thing that we don't even imagine right now, mm-hmm. and we'll have to figure out the rules of the road for that too. But right now we're just still trying to navigate those things. And of course, the big one is that for parents, especially for parents who are older, maybe 40 and older, you're still dealing in that instance with more of a digital divide. And there are a lot of parents, it doesn't even have to do with age, but there are still a lot of parents that don't feel the most apt when it comes to technology, that the child knows far more about technology than they do. And in some ways, the child is the guardian of the technology in the home, because the child knows how to, you know, debug something. The child knows how to, you know, figure out the control systems.
Sure.
The child knows how to do all these things before the parent ever figures it out. And as a result, there's sort of a power shift that happens in the home as a result of those things. That's kind of, and for some homes, that can be kind of a scary thing.
It kind of defeats the purpose when you have to ask your child to enter in the password.
It totally does. Absolutely.
It makes me think of times like back in the day when this is really showing how old I am, VCRs. And yeah. when our family had a VCR and I went away to college and come home and the power had gone off, so the clock on the VCR was blinking and I'd have to reset it for my parents because they aren't digital natives. They're not, you know, that's not something that they grew up with necessarily. Mm-hmm. And it was too confusing in order for them to try to figure out how to reset the clock on that. So, you know, right. That was my job every time I came home from college was to yep. reset the clock on the VCR. And that's just kind of a glimpse of what it's like now for yep. this generation, as children are they've grown up with this technology, their minds are being wired for this technology. They adapt to it so much quicker than we do. They don't even really have to adapt. They just, it's a part of everyday life for them.
Yeah, it is. It is. And so again, if parents feel that kind of that divide, then there are tons of resources out there to help with that. You know, it's important to be, you know, it's important to know what technology does. This is all, it's kind of like, you know, you don't, if you don't know what a lock on a door does, if you don't know what a key in a lock looks like, you don't look at that and say like, well, I see this hole and I see this thing that looks like a key and I don't really know how this works. So I'm just going to leave the door unlocked and just let anybody into my house that I want. No, you don't do that. You say, well, no, I'm going to figure out how a key works so I can lock my house. And so people don't come in and break in and do stuff. Same thing with, you know, if you had a stranger knock on your door and say, you know, I'd like to spend a few moments alone up in their bedroom with your daughter, if you don't mind. And I just need you to kind of shut the door behind me and just let me have some time alone with your daughter. I don't think we would be like, oh, yeah, sure, come on in. We wouldn't do that. We'd say, no, I have standards about this stuff. I'm not just going to let this kind of stuff happen. But the thing is, with technology, it's the same thing. When we give our kids unmonitored internet access, and they have all the passwords, and they have all the passcodes, and they have all the locks, then we have essentially left everything unlocked, and we have let the world of strangers into the minds and lives of our children, and we've just said, oh, that's okay, because it's all just technology. Well, no, it doesn't work that way. We have to, as diligent parents, we have to overcome. We have to accept the learning curve, not make excuses for it, and just learn. And then on top of that, we have to be parents. We can't just try to be buddy-buddy with our kids and be very permissive with no rules, no restrictions, no guardrails. Kids need and ultimately want guardrails because they want and need the wisdom of their parents. So we need that. We need to give them that. And that's important. Recognizing that, that may not make you popular, but it's sure going to keep your kids from a whole lot of danger. And in the end, it's not, like I said before, it's not just about shoring up. It's not just about protecting. It's not just about the filters and the blocks and the locks on things. It's about how do I train my child to live eventually as an adult outside the fence?
Mm-hmm.
I can train them while they're in the fence, and that's great. And we need the fence because the fence is helpful as long as they're here. But once they leave the fence, do they know enough about what's beyond it and how to deal with it, that they've become their own watchdogs? And that is why accountability is so powerful, because it's not just like a filter that blocks everything and you don't hear anything about it. Accountability is that constant, regular opportunity for you to know what's going on and then to have moment by moment, day by day, week by week, instant by instant conversations about helping them to have discernment, helping them to have wisdom. To the point where finally, if they're heading off to college, they're saying, we're actually seeing this now with Covenant Eyes users. It's really cool. Covenant Eyes has been around for 14 years. And so we're finally starting to see more of these stories of kids who've grown up with Covenant Eyes in their home, which 10 years ago wasn't the case. But now we're seeing it. Kids have grown up with it in the home and are now coming, at 18 years old, they're going off to college and they're saying to their parents, I want this on my computer, I want this on my phone, and I still want you to be my accountability partners, mom and dad, because I have learned the value of this in my own life, and I want to continue this. That is, to me, that is the great success story of Covenant Eyes, is that we can raise a new generation that values a culture of accountability over versus a culture of anonymity and secrecy. That's the value, and that's the success story. And, in 14 more years from now, I'd like to see what massive changes have taken place in culture as a result of it. We want to see everybody held accountable, choosing to be held accountable online because they see the value of it, because they know it's something important.
Hmm. It's neat to see how that has shaped that generation of teens who are now going off to college.
Yeah.
Not just with being online and safety online. Quite often we think of pornography. That's the first thing, obviously, that comes to mind when we think of the bad stuff that we want to consider and prevent when it comes to our young people having mobile devices. But some other things that come to mind and were mentioned in some of the recent blog posts as well. The freemiums. I think this is important for parents to know about when we're talking about free apps and how quickly someone can run up a bill or can spend a lot of money pretty easily just in a short matter of time. What are freemiums?
Freemiums are you can have a free app, mm-hmm. right? And there's a ton of free apps, free games, all kinds of stuff. But what happens is that built into those apps are opportunities to spend money on whatever the initiative of the app is. So take, for example, I've got an app on my phone right now called Hungry Shark. Okay, it's a free app. I play it about once a day for about 5 minutes. And the point of the game is you're a shark and you swim around the water and you eat stuff. And you eat stuff to stay alive. And then there's bigger things in the water that try to kill you. It's kind of fun. So anyway, I play Hungry Shark. Well, all throughout the game, everywhere you go, there are opportunities to shortcut things. I can upgrade to the next big new shark if I pay a little money. I can bump up my speed or my agility if I pay a little bit of money. I can shortcut what is built into the game already, right? If I just kept playing at a normal pace, I would get these things anyway. But who wants to wait? I want to just get the big cool shark right now, so I'm going to pay some money in order to do that. And there are games, free games, that make hundreds of thousands of dollars for their game makers, which is really funny to think about, that a free game is earning these people money. But it is. It's earning these people money. The article you're talking about, Kim Kardashian Hollywood, which is a game, kind of a trite game where people are upgrading their statuses in the minds of Hollywood culture, and it's kind of this ridiculous little.
It's on your phone game. Too, isn't it?
Yes, it's on my phone. I confess, I hang out with Kim Kardashian every day, right? So you get this app, and you start, and then you can with a little bit of money, you can bump up your status very easily, and this is projected this year to make $85 million. $85 million for a free game. And so kids, now, of course, this is just part of what goes into these freemiums. But parents need to know that. Now, there has been some legislation that's come out in order to try to protect against these things, so kids can't just mindlessly do it. Often what was happening before was there was a lot of people who were doing these upgrades not realizing they were spending money, and then there was all these, conflicts with credit card companies and app companies and stuff like that. But they have done some stuff to try to protect against this. But this is the kind of stuff that can still happen, especially if kids have access to their own, iTunes account where they can make these upgrades without parents knowing, that kind of stuff. And that stuff needs to be, definitely protected. You don't want to just give your kids carte blanche, a blank check on do whatever you want. Or if you do give them that, you want to give them an allowance with it, and say, hey, you've got $10 a month to spend on, a new, more songs or upgrades or whatever you're going to do. But you don't want to be out of the know with stuff like that.
Right.
You want to know what they're doing and what they're spending money on.
We've got less than a minute left, but I had to add that it's not just games that these in-app purchases
yes.
are included in. Even one of my fitness apps, one of my workout apps, you can buy like points, if you're trying to meet a certain goal for the week, this totally defeats the purpose, in my opinion. You can buy points so that you can, quote unquote, stay on track with your fitness goals for the week. It's like we need a reformation when it comes to fitness, apparently, too.
Apparently, yes. Yeah, that's nice.
Well, Luke, I appreciate all that you've shared with us today and
yeah.
provided some tips. We'll provide a link to Covenant Eyes as well with the archive of today's program in the on-demand section when that's posted on our website at KFUO.org. You can check out Covenant Eyes at covenanteyes.com. You can find it there online, covenanteyes.com. You can find out the resources they have there. And go check out the blog. Luke does a great job with the blog. Luke, thanks so much for being our guest on Faith and Family today, providing some tips for us for parents, especially with kids and teens using mobile devices.
Great. Thank you, Andy.
Coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word. I'm going to study God's Word here with Pastor Whedon and guest right here on Listener Supported Worldwide, KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.